Good evening. This is Henry Banks, senior producer and host of People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining me tonight, Duluth, Minnesota City Council President Noah Hobbs. We're going to be talking about the TIF financing, community development block grant funding, homelessness in Duluth, Minnesota. We're going to be talking about communities of color and programs funded in the city and more. All of this coming up next on People of Color with Henry Banks after this news. Thank you. This is People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Henry Banks. Thanks for joining us this evening. I'm here in the studio tonight with Duluth, Minnesota City Council President Noah Hobbs. He is joining me tonight to talk about a variety of things. I have a lot of questions for you, Mr. Councilor, and welcome to People of Color. Thank you again for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, you know, I know you're a very busy person, especially being the city council president. You have a lot of different roles attached to that. You're an at-large city councilor, but you're also president of the city council. What does it mean for you as president of the city council? So what of your additional roles that maybe our listeners don't know? What are some of your additional roles once you take that role as president?
Yeah, setting the agenda is one of the biggest in orders when we have meetings, when we have committee of the whole. All of those things is the role of the president, and then working with fellow counselors to figure out if there's a topic that they want to have a committee of the whole on. We're going to be having a sexual harassment training to the council, not this next meeting, but the meeting after. And that was brought up by myself and Councilor Eric Forsman. And so part of that is council president is setting that agenda, and then working with administration as the liaison between the council and the mayor.
Okay. So does the city council ever implement suggest, for example, in the African Heritage Community of Duluth, the Native Heritage Community of Duluth, it doesn't seem as though those populations are thriving in the city of Duluth. So would the city council ever enact an ordinance to start to tackle some of those disparities, for example, in housing and education and this, that, and the other, as a leader to working on some of those issues that exist in those communities?
Yeah, so that's certainly not a unique to just Duluth issue. And I think that the difficulty with anything education-wise is we have a school board. Some cities actually have control of their school districts as well as their city municipal services. Duluth does not have that joint power. It's actually separated power. So it gets tough to do anything from the city side on education. And where it gets tough on housing to get so specific is a lot of, you know, Fair Lending Act and a lot of the Fair Housing Act is you can't necessarily make specific loan products or specific housing complexes for individuals based off of gender or race. And one of the things that's has been successful in helping overwhelmingly households of color versus white households in home ownership, for example, was it's called Self-Help Credit Union out in North Carolina or South Carolina. It's a lending nonprofit, and what they did was subprime lending without betting on households to fail. And so they certainly had a higher delinquency rate on making loans to folks that had poor credit, lower income, but that was actually one of the only programs in the country that has moved the needle on homeownership disproportionately for households of color. And that, but that's a significant capital investment that they raised from either foundations, other nonprofits, and fundraising activities. And so can a city, we can continue to advocate for, you know, adding additional affordable housing units in general, and continue to do job training programs where there's priority given to minority-owned contractors or contractors that employ minority-owned subcontractors and various things like that, and working with the trades to increase that outreach. So those are some of the things that we have done in the city, and that's, I think, a focus of certainly this council and Mayor Larson.
Affordable housing, I would suggest, is probably a big issue in Duluth. people I've talked to have said affordability for apartments and things of that nature don't exist in Duluth, Minnesota. And so why is that? Why is there really virtually no affordability in Duluth? You know, the salaries and wages are not very high for a lot of people there, but it seems as though the rental rates are exorbitantly high in comparison to other major cities like Minneapolis and elsewhere.
Yeah, so our it's comparable to a lot of the regional population centers. St. Cloud, Mankato, Rochester, and St. Paul, Minneapolis have a lot of similar issues. And some of the things that we can't do is the state legislature does not allow rent control. Part of what makes Duluth slightly unaffordable housing-wise is we have a lower median income. Mm-hmm. We also have folks that want to live here, and we don't have the housing units available for them at this time. So that drives up the market price because owners of properties are able to charge more because people can pay for that. And I think the other pressure that we have is a significant student population that doesn't have on-campus housing options, and our partners at Lake Superior College are stepping up, and the University of Minnesota Duluth are stepping up. There's two student housing complexes coming online in the next 2 years, and hopefully we can see some more of that because it's easier for a landlord to rent out to, would be a single-family home to four students that are able to pay a rent versus if you are a family with two income earners and have two kids, you're going to have, you know, three or four bedrooms, and only one of those bedrooms will likely be bringing in an income with that those income earners, and those children won't be. And so there's an incentive to rent to students because you can fetch a higher price than what you would from a typical household.
So you mentioned rent control, and you said Duluth doesn't have rent control, but Minneapolis has rent control.
They do not have rent control in the same way that St. Paul or that New York would have. What they have is several, if they use a Minnesota Housing Finance Agency product, you can have, so the lender can put on a rent control, but the state or the, so the municipality currently does not have the authority to enact rent control saying that this unit is going to be X dollars. If that landlord takes on financing or takes on a property tax break from the city, then they can do mandate what the percentage of area median income rent would be.
So this is brings me to my next question.
Sure.
So recently, the city council through DEDA approved this TIF district, tax increment financing districts, for a major development that's coming into downtown Duluth, 204 units, 15 floors, all luxury units, $2,995 for a two-bedroom unit, $1,300 plus for a studio unit. So, but the developers are going to get $6.2 million in tax increment financing. But there's not a plan, or at least I haven't seen a plan, where there's going to be any affordable apartments in the building. So if the developer is coming in and they're saying, well, we can't find this $6.2 million, so we need the city to, in this case, DEDA, to support us and create a tax increment financing district, but there's not a plan for affordable apartments. So why would you, as a council and as Duluth Economic Development Authority, why would you support a project like that when there's no mention of, at this point, no intention of having affordable units in that building?
Yeah, and so that project isn't intended to be affordable or workforce housing. What it is geared towards is higher earners from Essentia, and that is that developer's business plan. And so without, you know, that $6.2 million, that project wouldn't happen. And through the Maxfield study, which was commissioned, Maxfield Housing Study commissioned in 2014, we do have to add in Duluth from 2014 all the way to 2020, about 180 of those types of units. And so that is in line with the needs that we have in the city. And we have a significantly higher need for lower income, so deeply subsidized housing and affordable housing as well. Part of when the market steps forward, there's more money to be made in higher end housing, and to finance and construct lower income housing is a lot of different financing mechanisms. Certainly, we could use TIF for one of those projects, but there's also low income tax credits. There's historic tax credits. There's 4% tax credits. There's 9% tax credits, and all of those you can use and cobble together to make a low income or subsidized housing development work. I think what a lot of folks were trying to talk about during, why are there no affordable units in this, the 333 project, is exclusionary zoning is kind of the policy program that people wanted to reference and saying, well, at least have 10 of them be, affordable.
Why couldn't it be? Why couldn't 10 or 15 even be affordable in this apartment building? And I'm going to let you finish, but yeah. Why couldn't that be the case? Especially since one of the developers, because we've been doing our research here, one of the developers is a multi-billionaire from Chicago.
Sure.
And that's Gerald Fogelson. He owns properties in 8 different states. That includes Minnesota. He recently was a part of a 26-building apartment townhome luxury units in Chicago, where there were approximately 10,000 residents in this development. They were all high-income units. A 3-bedroom apartment in one of those buildings rents for $6,000 a month. A 2-bedroom rents for $3,500 a month. So I'm asking you, why couldn't these developers find that $6.2 million somewhere else other than going for a TIF district, which the city of Duluth has at least 13 that are active to this date? It was 19, and so it's now down to 13, according to the city auditor, that are active and running right now, and our community taxpayers are footing the bill for this. So why is it that it's so difficult for the developers to come up with that $6.2 million? Are you aware of this developer at all and all of the property that he owns? I mean, he's worth at least $5 billion, if not more.
Yeah, and he's not he's certainly not the sole developer
right.
in this. But
and I'm aware of that. I'm aware.
Yeah,
of that.
And to answer the question, why not? We don't have an inclusionary zoning policy in the city. Duluth does not necessarily have a hot real estate market at the moment, and likely never will, to that of New York or San Francisco or Charlottesville, where these markets have been really hot when it comes to real estate development. And so there's difficulties in that. We had conversations, I did specifically with the developer, asking if we were to reduce or eliminate height restrictions, if you could put a unit, a whole floor scattered throughout the building of affordable housing, and that's not how their business model works. And so that's fine.
But Councilor Hobbs, though, they're asking for taxpayer dollars, right? They're asking for infrastructure money that the city coffers will not realize for 25 years. And so if they're asking for the city to help them come up with this $6.2 million, they need to be told that they must do this, because the taxpayers, again, are bailing these very wealthy people out. They could have come up with the $6.2 million. They came up with the additional money that, before they came to the city, they had already made millions of dollars. Why couldn't they come up with the $6.2 million and build the property without the tax increment financing?
Yeah, so the cash flow models return on investment around 7%, and this is slightly less than that. And so, it's disingenuous to say they're getting bailed out. This project wouldn't happen without that infrastructure cleanup. And this project will generate significant property tax revenue
after 25 years, right?
No, until the $6.2 million is recaptured. And
how long will that take, do you know?
It can go 25 years. However, with the development that's happening, nearly $1 billion in private dollars that are happening in development downtown, It would not be out of the question for this to be a much more rapidly disappearing TIF district.
So and I'm not convinced yet. I just need you to really tell our listeners. So are you really telling our listeners that if they were not able to get that $6.2 million TIF district, that this project would not have happened?
Correct. And that's through state statute, is that TIF money cannot be used in a project that would happen without that financing. It's called the but-for test. But for that financing, that project would not, in fact, happen.
So it's okay for the $6.2 million TIF to go to people who have tons of money, who could really have paid for this and probably not have missed it, but now the city's on the line? I mean, help me understand that. Help our listeners understand that. Because here again, we have all of these TIF districts that are active.
Which
somebody has to pay for that.
Sure. And we have, you know, 13 sounds like a high number, and 19 does as well. But we have 4.2% of Duluth's property tax base captured in a TIF district. St. Louis Park leads the state, and they're at, I think, 18%. So we are on the lower end, the lower third for TIF district financing, and so Duluth hasn't relied very heavily on it at all. And you look at Illinois and Chicago specifically, I think it's 68% of their property tax is captured in a TIF. And so to push back on that and to say that would we use TIF district to finance low-income affordable housing? Sure, absolutely, whatever it would take. And so I think the problem or any of the angst in this is that we're pitting this project against low-income housing projects or affordable housing projects that currently aren't on the docket. We have two or three developments currently in the works that we're trying to cobble together the financing for. If it was TIF that was needed for that, for those developers, they should certainly feel free to try it out and go through the legal means of testing the but-for mechanism, and I feel confident that they would be successful in getting it.
Well, why wouldn't you say something like this? If those multimillionaires and multibillionaires come to you, and there have been others who have lots of money that have come to the city of Duluth and says, well, we can't do this project unless we get the TIF district. These folks have a lot of money, but again, it seems as though, and a lot of folks that are listening will probably acknowledge that, it seems as though the city is using TIF district financing willy-nilly, if you will. And so there are some politicians in our research that we've done have said that exact thing. They believe that Duluth has used TIF district financing too readily. Do you agree with that?
I disagree with that.
And these are some of your colleagues that are saying that. And so Duluth is a small community. And to have that many active TIF districts right now appears to be troubling, because it seems as though, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems as though those with a lot of money are getting more benefits and those with less money are not getting much at all.
Yeah, and I would say to push back on the number of TIF districts, again, it's for 4.2%, which is not significant and is on the lower end. So if there are I have colleagues saying that we are using TIF willy-nilly. I think that's an inaccurate portrayal of what is really going on, and they're not digging into the numbers and what other cities are doing. So in a realistic world, if we would not have provided, you know, but for the $6.2 million to offset, you know, the demo of those three buildings, the infrastructure for a high-rise and all of that, it's very well that they could go to Hermantown, Superior, Proctor, or a surrounding area in which they would have a green field to develop on. The other thing that I don't know if we're going to talk about later is the opportunity zones, and that actually maintains that this developer has to stay there for 10 years and not be a turnkey in where they turn around and sell it. And we actually are the first city in the state of Minnesota to utilize opportunity zones, and that is an added level of benefit that makes it comfortable for me to say yes to that, is that it maintains this as 10 years. And if, you know, I've had some constituents say that this project's going to fail, If it does, it allows for deeply subsidized units. And so in the fact of folks that want to say we're not spending taxpayer money on this and then also in the same vein say it's going to fail, it appears that that would be the same outcome, mm-hmm. That they're going to get deeply subsidized housing units in a complex that they opposed. And I think that, look, I understand that housing finance is highly, highly complex and complicated, and it depends on how you use it and how you layer it. You know, we have done a lot of, through the Minnesota Department of Education and Economic Development, we have used workforce housing grants for several projects up by the mall on transit lines, and that's been helpful. You know, we've not done enough for low-income housing, but that's because it's much more difficult to finance, and we are actively always looking for it. I think that the Essentia development opens up a significant space around their campus in which we can look at how do we have more affordable housing, how do we find, you know, more locations for student housing. I mean, part of it is the U of M system doesn't allow for student housing complexes to be built unless it's 100% fully funded, and that's an internal policy that I can't change as a counselor that mm-hmm. You know, even the state can't change. It has to be through their Board of Regents. And so it is incredibly complex to add as many units as we need to. And we don't have, you know, cornfields where I'm from, Mankato. You just buy a cornfield and you put up 130 units overnight with having, contractors that just put up the frame and then they do the inside, all the production builder. We don't have that luxury here, and that drives up cost. And so it is more expensive to build in Duluth also than it would be in a Rochester, a St. Cloud, and St. Paul and Minneapolis. And you have investors that are willing to take a larger risk in St. Paul, Minneapolis, because that is actually a truly hot real estate market.
That's interesting. I'm here with Noah Hobbs. He's the president of the Duluth City Council. We're talking housing and all kinds of housing, different types of housing. Noah, I know you know what you're talking about. You know your job well as a city councilor. But in Duluth, so if this apartment building is final and it's built and the rents are what they're going to be, most people in Duluth would not be able to afford to live there. So you're paying $36,000 a year just to live in an apartment building. Most people in Duluth don't earn $36,000 a year. At least a lot of them don't. Some people who earn $80,000 a year still would struggle to afford to live in this building because there are thresholds that people have to meet in order to be even considered before they get in the door. And so that project automatically is excluding a lot of people, right? It's excluding a lot of people. I know there are several other projects in Duluth that aren't, if you will, the Bluestone Commons and others like that, that are high-income units. I know Bluestone received the tax increment financing district. Others in the community where housing is exorbitantly high have received TIF districts. So what
I don't actually – I don't believe Bluestone received TIF. Kenwood did, and Andy did, but I don't believe Bluestone was a recipient of TIF financing.
Okay, so that project was done without TIF district financing.
I believe so.
Okay, so I stand corrected, but I don't believe that's the case because
sure.
I know the developer. So I have to ask you, if most people can't afford this new project that's coming up, why do it, right? It's not always about money.
Yeah, I mean, we have a housing shortage in Duluth. And back to that Maxfield research study, we do have to add 180 units for high-income earners a year. And the benefit of having a complex like this remove somebody that's going to make, you know, I don't associate with people that make over $200,000, but they are there. And
they are there, absolutely.
They are our neighbors. And if you can take somebody that's a high-income earner out of a home in West Duluth that they're currently renting or in, you know, Lincoln Park, Lakeside, Congdon, whichever neighborhood they choose, that unit is highly likely to be exponentially more affordable than the unit in this complex. And if they are choosing to live in the 333 project, which is highly likely that they will given the housing shortage, it is going to open up a more affordable unit for somebody on the, you know, a tier lower on the economic scale, and they can climb up. And then if that person moves into that home, it'll allow a more affordable unit to open up. And so it does have a, you know, either a ladder up, trickle down, however you want to call it. But it takes somebody that has capacity to pay in this type of apartment complex out of a home that may be more affordable for somebody like myself or someone, you know, a little worse off. And that's an added benefit to it. I mean, I think that's something that's, you know, more broad of a conversation on. It doesn't solve everything. There's no silver bullet in affordable housing. But this will have a positive benefit in that regard, because it's going to open up more affordable units through the community for somebody to have access to that wouldn't have prior to this.
Okay, so we're going to move on in just a moment. But, okay, so they're building another luxury building on 4th Street, okay, across from the Steve O'Neill Apartments. Those are going to be 96 luxury units. They did not get a TIF district. And those are going to be luxury units. So please explain what the difference is.
Yeah, so those ones aren't luxury. The City View Flats compared to
they're going to be 2,000 a month.
Which is significantly less than the 333 one. And there's also a what they have done at the City View Flats is actually keep eight or ten units. There was a triplex that was three triplexes that were demolished in that they've kept those internally, will be rent controlled through the developer. And so the site work for that project is significantly less. The demolition was significantly less than what the 333 project had to go through, and the infrastructure required on that is significantly less. So given that site, they didn't require the type of financing and it's also not as it's not 15 stories. I mean, that's
– Well, that's true.
Yeah.
That's
I mean, it to build something 15 stories is a significantly different, more expensive cost in building up. So it's a different business model, different building, building material and site.
And I want to just tell our listeners a little bit more here about Gerald Fogelson. So he's very wealthy. We all know that. He's a real estate mogul in Chicago. He's an author, a very high-selling author. He has high-end properties in 8 states. They are California, Florida, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Minnesota, New Jersey, and Ohio. And according to Cook County, Illinois records of deeds, Fogelson recently listed his 2-floor, 4,800-square-foot condo for $3.5 million, up $1.3 million from when he bought that property in 2006. So again, it appears as though if you're a wealthy developer, you can come into a community and say, well, we can't build this particular building unless we get this from the city. That seems disingenuous also.
Yeah, and I would push. I don't believe that's true, because again, we haven't had a low income project or a deeply subsidized housing project developer come and ask for TIF. They certainly can.
Yep. I was going to ask you, what's the standard? So, how does DITA or the city decide who gets a TIF district and who does not?
Yeah, so it's through if you're in a developer, you approach, you do your pro forma and all of that on how the building is going to cash flow, depreciate, maintain, and all of that. And if there is a gap with the site acquisition, site preparation, environmental cleanup, and all of that in demolition, that's evident in a pro forma that the site prep is significant cost. And then if that amount of money, which would be, you know, essentially equity, comes at the effect of building that project, then you can approach DITA, the city, say, I think we might be eligible for, but for this financing would not happen, so we approach for TIF. At that point, there are various firms that do a model, an independent model, to see if the numbers really do merit TIF. And then that person, that entity comes back with their report in which DITA looks over and says, yes, this, you know, the firm does agree that this is a TIF-eligible project, or it says that this is not a TIF-eligible project. So there is a third party involved in which looks and says this is or is not a valid TIF project. And that's how that happens. And it is a highly scrutinized process. It doesn't just happen overnight.
And a lot of people know you made a statement at the city council meeting. And so a lot of folks contacted me to ask you, What did you mean by that statement? Because it could have been construed and taken several different ways. What did you mean by that statement?
Yeah, I mean, I've clarified the comment once, and I will certainly do it again. But yeah, in the context of attracting folks to live in Duluth, I think that is the best life choice that someone can make, is living in the city of Duluth versus Superior and Hermantown. And that's, I think if you watch the full four and a half minutes, it's very evident that it's more of a cheerleading comment of Duluth and not a statement on anyone's economic earning.
So
potential.
It was tongue-in-cheek, basically. Is that what you're saying?
It was very tongue-in-cheek, and I think if you watch the full four minutes and 30 seconds, it is pretty evident.
Because somebody in Superior might be saying, well, what do you mean by that? Hermantown is saying, well, what do you mean by that when you say that? It would be better for folks to live in Duluth?
Well,
is
yeah.
Duluth all of a sudden something special?
I mean, I think that Duluth is special. And as an elected representative of Duluth, part of my job is to be a cheerleader. And
right on, I get that.
We certainly can work together with Superior and Hermantown in addressing our economic struggles. But at the end of the day, I do want folks to live in Duluth. It makes it,
They're all special areas, though. Superior is a special area, Hermantown, as is Duluth.
Right.
And so I think that's some of the confusion that people have. It's like, well, don't live there and don't live there, but come to Duluth. That's how it sounded for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I would stand by the fact that I think that Duluth is the most special of three very special places, and folks should move to Duluth. And I'm not going
to
back down from being I will not back down from being a cheerleader for Duluth. I think to push back and address if it was based off of anyone's social, economic well-being, that's disingenuous to come at, I think, me for that, given that if there was somebody that needed TIF for a low-income project, I would be equally as supportive of it as there is a need for it, as there is for a project of this scale.
Sure. I really appreciate this conversation, but, Duluth is special, Superior is special, Hermantown is special. These are very beautiful communities. And I think collectively, when working together, that's when the communities become stronger. I'll just leave it at that. So do you believe, though, that the decision to support this TIF district, do you believe that was controversial at all? Do you see any controversy in that?
I think it was made controversial. I think the narrative of saying that this project is coming at the expense of a subsidized housing project or a workforce housing gave the appearance of it being controversial. The fact that this project is not in competition with an affordable housing project or a workforce housing project does not make it controversial. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find a stronger advocate for affordable housing on the Duluth Council than myself. And I don't think it was controversial. I can see where folks would try to make a controversy out of it. But the fact that this project is not in competition with any other funding mechanisms or taking away funding from a affordable or low income housing project, I don't see it as controversial.
I appreciate that. So, okay, just a few more questions on the TIF and all that kind of stuff. So now we have this project. It's going to happen in downtown Duluth. What folks who listen to my show and others constantly ask me to do is ask you and folks who are political, the mayor and city councilors and county commissioners and state and national elected representatives, whatever. So because Duluth, Minnesota has a history of not providing adequate resources to communities of color, from the area of employment opportunities, educational opportunities for advancement, although we have the educational facilities in the community. My point and question is this. Would you advocate as a leader on the city council in making sure that unions, construction companies, other entities, especially with this new housing unit going downtown and the hospital stuff that's happening, Would you make sure that people of color and women are given opportunities just like everybody else for some of that work? Because that's going to be a lot of work. And what typically happens in this community, this region, is that communities of color, whether or not some say are they skilled enough or not, I happen to believe they are still not getting those jobs, are not getting hired by the unions to get those jobs in those construction companies. And it happens year after year after year after year, and we constantly are building and building and building in Duluth, and only a few people are benefiting from it. People of color are not benefiting from any of this. If they're benefiting, it's so minute you don't recognize it. What leadership, Mr. Hobbs, would you provide to make sure that these developers and these folks who are coming to the city for money, for infrastructure resources, what are you going to do, if anything, to advance that conversation so that it then becomes not just a human rights officer job, but an entire city job, an entire construction company job, an entire union official's job to make sure that people of color and women are getting some opportunities in these jobs?
Yeah, so the Mayor Larson just went through her new business subsidy plan, and that was an ordinance that this council passed a handful of months ago. And that actually mandates that if there's a project that receives any more than $100,000 in public financing, that it has to have a project labor agreement, which entails, I think it's 15% women or minorities be hired on a project. And so there are points, preferences for that. And that's, I mean, that's big. We haven't had that until about 6 months ago. And so we're going to see, you know, the Superior Street construction next year. We'll have that. 333 is going to have that. Essentia is going to have that. And all these entities are using our, you know, friends in labor. And, you know, labor is doing better. They still have a ways to go. But I think that that is the appropriate venue in which you can have more say on who, you know, who is hired and outreach.
Want skilled people. We're not saying just go and hire people just to be hiring people because there are certain whatever. Yeah. It's about being skilled also. So, but what are you going to do as far as, you know, you're a top leader on that council, and a lot of folks look up to you to provide leadership that is adequate, that is attainable, that is sustainable for every single person eligible to work or whatever to be in Duluth, Minnesota. So folks are looking to you, and they want to hear from you as to what you're going to do. Are you going to take some risk in making sure that what the mayor wants implemented is exactly what the council wants implemented too?
Yeah, I mean, I share the goals of Mayor Larson with the business subsidy. You know, if I was in the position of mayor, I would have done the same thing. My first year in council, we removed on the truly entry-level jobs within the city of Duluth, specifically in the Parks Department, removed the need to have a driver's license. There's a lot of folks, people of color and low income, that don't have a driver's license, mm-hmm. or they've been formerly incarcerated. It's actually a really high expense to get your license reinstated. So we have removed that barrier. And I think that you know, working with the trades, it does take time, because to be an apprentice, that's a long process. To be a skilled worker, you don't do that overnight. You don't, you know, apply and say, I'm willing to work. It does take a significant amount of training. And so we'll see it catch up. And it probably won't be this next year where we'll hit that 15%, because there is that training. And when I worked with the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency up in Virginia, a community action agency program, we worked, created a program with the carpenters to getting women into non-traditional fields. And we worked with the Carpenters Union on having slots and courses developed for them specifically. So it was a lower barrier, less intimidating, a cohort of all females to go through as they learn the basic skills to enter in that apprenticeship program and have an $18 an hour job. So anytime that we can partner with the trades, I will continue to support that, and I'll continue to go after funding for and financing for low-income housing projects when they come along, and take advantage of that.
You're running for re-election, or in 2020, or what?
I do have to make that decision at this point, and not, you know, not to be cheeky or duck, I would be inclined to run, but you know, I'm 29 years old. I don't know what my family life entails, mm-hmm. and I have found it an incredibly rewarding opportunity to serve the people of Duluth, and would certainly like another term, but there are some, I think, family decisions that I have to make on my end.
So, not for mayor, though?
I am not running for mayor. Okay. I do enjoy, you know, my employment at Wonderful Community Housing very much, and it's been a privilege to work both in that field and then for the city of Duluth.
So, since you mentioned that, you're director of lending services at One Roof, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
So, let's go to CDBG funding and stuff. So, I again, we have a really wonderful research group here that works with me, and I've been doing some research, and my production assistant's been doing some research, and so I pulled the CDBG stuff, right? It's about $3 million or what have you in CDBG funding. Your organization, it looks like, is eligible for a significant amount of these dollars.
Sure.
For the work that they do. As a city councilor, would you recuse yourself from voting on any of this funding as it relates to the whole entire package of money?
Yeah, I don't. I can't take votes on CDBG funding if it pertains, if I financially benefit from it. So I've abstained from it.
Okay. Our listeners needed to hear that because you don't want to be accused of voting on something that's going to be benefiting you or your agency.
Right.
And so having said that, I know for a number of years, communities of color, organizations of color that are led by people of color have been applying to CDBG. And it seems as though there's a scoring system that the staff uses in planning and community development. It seems as though those entities where the majority of which were communities of color, it seemed as though their scores were lower. Is that a fair process, in your opinion?
Yeah, having never sat on the Community Development Committee, in which scores these proposals, and not having worked for the city in the Planning Department, I can't speak to whether it's fair or unfair. My feeling would be that it is, you know, part of the component. Having applied for these dollars, is you have to show, you know, a budget and past historical performance is always very helpful, and that's where any, you know, a new organization could have some difficulty. And I think the other difficulty we've had is, you know, community development block grants have came out of the 80s out of the federal administration, and they've remained stagnant. And anytime something remains stagnant for 20 plus years, it's effectively a cut. And so we have a smaller pie to fund programs and projects with these dollars. And I mean, that's a whole other debate if CDBG is effective in the form as a block grant for funding. But I think that we're at about, I want to say maybe $2 or $3 million less if we would have just even increased with inflation on the cost of CDBG allocations. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a two-part of there's less money to go around, and with those dollars, you want to have the most meaningful impact. I can tell you as an elected official, you do need to say, you need to show a return on investment that is as significant as possible.
How then would those new organizations ever come up with any funding from CDBG? It just doesn't seem as though that would happen, because there are organizations, as you suggest, that have been getting CDBG funding every single year. However, the change in making life better for people seems to stay the same, and they continue to get money. So those new entities that come in are scored lower because they don't have history, but they have something new and innovative that they're doing in the community, and they don't get the funding. How is that fair if those organizations that have been getting the CDBG funds for the last 10 or 15 years and the results are minimal, why should they continue to get funding?
I would put, if there's an organization or a project that is going to promise to be a huge accelerant on addressing our societal ills, it would attract a lot of funding from not just CDBG pots. I mean, there are just an affordable low-income affordable housing financing. How you cobble together funding for various nonprofits is also probably more laborious than starting a business with financing. I mean, you can cobble together CDBG dollars. You can approach a foundation. You can approach a variety of other folks for seed money. And so, I think that we do have, to my knowledge, a fair process. I think there is a difficulty anytime that you're starting with that. And CDBG isn't necessarily a program geared at having a start for somebody. I think it's used to provide a subsidy if it's purchasing a home and rehabbing it below market, mm-hmm. If it's a job training, program through or offender reentry types, community action programs is where a lot of it, and they've done the lobbying on the federal level for, many, many years since the 80s as a way to continue their programming. So is it inherently unfair by design? Probably not, but I think that it's tough starting anything, whether it be a for-profit business, a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. Very difficult.
Yeah, and so I'd push back on saying that it's not unfair. It is more difficult, but for those entities that pushed through and continue to, secure funding, it is, it was difficult for them at one point as well. So there's no perfect answer except for more funding.
Okay, so Mr. Hobbs, I hear everything you're saying. I just need to ask you. So if those new entities that exist, I would say 99% of which at the moment happen to be organizations of color, led by leaders of color, were to go and apply for CDBG funds, some might say wasting their time to access those dollars, when will that process be fair enough to provide some kind of mechanism so that those new entities can get at least some kind of funding to do whatever, right? They're providing programs, not services necessarily, but providing programs to a significant population in the community, but because they're new, their chances of getting anything from CDBG are almost non-existent. That seems to be a serious disconnect.
Yeah, is there a specific, it's easy to have a conversation on, it's difficult to have a conversation on, faceless applications, yeah. on merit.
If this is just hypothetical stuff.
Yeah, and so, hypothetically, no, you still would have a chance if you can show that you have an outcome or best practices model from another program and expertise in that. It wouldn't be super difficult. I think anytime you're applying, it's not it's never fun applying for funding. It's you have to show what you're going to do, and you have to hit those goals. And that, not having a history does pose somewhat of a leap of faith. But to say that, if there's a proposal that comes forward and is credible and can do it, then they shouldn't have a difficulty in getting funding. No, so certainly to the person that's applying, you think that your application is always worth funding, and that's
right.
With limited resources, you do have to make the best decision. And so, is that process ever going to be, quote unquote fair? If there is, the adequate funding for it to take risks, then that would be it. But that is a federal choice that I cannot affect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So would the would you advocate for the city planning and CDBG departments to make sure that there are no duplication of services or programs in the CDBG ask of organizations in the community? Because I've done my research and over time have seen that there are several organizations that perennially get the dollars that are duplicating services and programs, and they're still getting funded. And that seems to be unfair for those new entities that aren't getting consideration.
Yeah, and so there are, you know, several of our homeless services providers provide, you know, similar services. They serve pretty different constituency bases, however. And so on the surface, it would appear that there is a duplication of services, but those dollars are highly unlikely being used on the same person through two different organizations. I mean, look at Lifehouse, which is youth homelessness, and CHUM, which you know, has some youth, but it's usually a youth with a parent, mm-hmm. a woman and children. And then, you know, Union Gospel Mission and Salvation Army. So there's there is not on the surface, there is an overlap.
Sure.
They serve very different constituencies with those dollars. And so I think it's a more in-depth look on who those organizations are conducting outreach to and how they are providing those services to their niche client base.
Interesting. So on any given day in Duluth, 600 people homeless, is that correct? 400 to 600, 800? What's
yeah,
that number?
It can be. So, yeah, homeless is defined if we want to talk about homeless folks that are living on a street and not on a friend's couch.
Yes.
It's probably closer to a 300 number. If you want to talk about homelessness of folks that don't have an address to
and
their home.
And that doubles probably.
It's probably around 600 to 800.
Okay.
And it's tough to get an accurate count on that, but it has decreased in the past 2 years a little bit. We certainly can do, you know, I say we can do more. We need help from the state. It's it is one of those things that the municipality has limited capacity to raise revenue for various projects to address it effectively.
So there's this warming shelter.
Yeah.
How's that going?
Good. We have Commissioner Patrick Boyle and myself are meeting with the senior volunteers and the seniors out at the Center City West tomorrow to go over the proposal, and that we're going to see how that's it's a pilot program. So we want to see how it works and the mechanics of it and how we can improve on it next year, and if we can secure more stable, dedicated funding for it. Right now, we don't have that, and so it's not going to be it's not going to solve the issue. It will certainly, I think, alleviate the burden of being homeless a handful of days this, you know, winter of 19. But it's not going to solve it because we don't have a full-time dedicated source of funding for it. But we want to see how it works, how we can do it here. Other cities have done it, Rochester, Minnesota, and so I think we can do it. And so it's going.
I'm wondering what the threshold is for when that center would open at night or what have you, what the temperature has to be or whatever for
yeah.
that to happen?
And that's, we're having a conversation on that, depending on resource limit. If it's, I know that the two temperatures that have been talked about is 20 degrees and below or 0 degrees and below. And being that this is a pilot, we have to best gauge in a changing climate how are we going to cover the most harsh days with public dollars? If we were to do a 2 or 3 weeks just continuous, it would not feel great to have it be, you know, 20 degrees every single one of those days. And there's still a risk at 20 degrees. I acknowledge that. But if you have that 3 week span of it at 20, you know, 19 degrees, and then the next 3 weeks you have, you know, you ran out of money, the pilot's over, and you're at -5. I'm going to feel a lot worse spending money on the 19 degrees than the -5. And, you know, it's not a fun conversation to have. At what point do you provide basic services for folks experiencing homelessness? But how do you do it to at least have the most impact in mitigating their situation temporarily? So whether it's 20 or 0, we have to figure out on the pilot what that looks like.
Yeah, as close as West Duluth.
Yeah.
You almost lost somebody the other day.
Right.
If it were not for the first responders, that individual may not have made it.
Right.
And the individual was sleeping in a sleeping bag in bitterly cold temperatures.
Right.
And, you know, we are the richest country on the face of the earth, and we still have homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, in my opinion, and I'm going to speak that, we can do better.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what former Senator, the late Senator Paul Wellstone said. When we do better, when we all do better, we all do better. And I think we're all obligated to make sure that we don't have homelessness in our communities. You know, we can't get rid of it totally, but we can certainly do something about it that's going to help people and keep them from freezing to death in this cold climate. I think we're obligated. That's just my opinion.
I share that opinion 100%.
Yes. So a couple more questions. So as a person of color and the show person of people of color, we talk a lot about people of color. We bring people of color and others in to talk about what they're doing in a positive way for communities of color. What would you say to folks listening right now as to really for 2019, whether or not you would be advocating for communities of color and communities of color issues and concerns at the state capitol so that some of those funds that are allocated come back to Duluth and go directly to organizations of color actually doing the work? Would you be a strong advocate for that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. Show me a program.
And February 26th is African Heritage Day on the Hill.
Sure.
Would you consent to being there to advocate for communities of color from Duluth?
Yeah, let me put it on my calendar.
Okay. I needed to ask you that because at least one busload of folks will be going down to St. Paul for that day on the Hill, and we're going to be they've asked me to join them. We're going to be talking to the state legislators from our region, asking them and demanding of them to make sure that they're advocating for us because they haven't done that. This is according to African Heritage leaders in Duluth. They're saying this, that our legislative delegation in Duluth has not advocated for African Heritage community concerns, and they are demanding that that happens. And so I just needed you to understand where they are and
sure.
that community is, because as I've been told by them, they're not taking no for an answer anymore. And so they look up to you as a leader. They look up to the legislative delegation as leaders, but the result always is zero for the African Heritage community. And so folks are getting tired.
Sure. Is there specific lobbying, you know, or bills that they're going after? I know that
there's several.
Sure.
There's several.
Yeah, yeah, I know restoring the vote is a big priority for Secretary of State Steve Simon, and he reiterated that at the inauguration yesterday to expand the right to vote for all felons that are off that are not incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a big step. I think that's, you know, voting is probably the biggest thing, because if you can't even vote on a local referendum, you feel more isolated from your community than you would, you know, not having that right. So,
and we here at the show, we don't say felons, we say returning citizens.
Sure.
Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, okay, folks, you did your time. So you're not X this or X that. You're a returning citizen. Now you have an opportunity to become a better person.
Sure.
And so here at the show, that's how we refer to it. And I'm hoping others will embrace that as well.
Sure. So
is there anything else, Councilor Hobbs, that you would like to leave with our listeners? I know I asked a lot of questions about TIF districts and this, that, and the other. That is very near and dear to the work that we do here, because we need to find answers for our listeners.
Yeah. I don't believe that I have anything to add other than, you know, I believe that this council is dedicated to affordable housing. And when those projects come along, they have been supported. And when they do continue to come forward, they will be supported. But there is a clear directive for our housing needs, how many units we need to have to add per income level. And we haven't done anything outside of that directive, adding too much of one income level and not enough of the other, or at the expense of the other. We certainly still have to add more affordable workforce housing, whichever term people want to use. At this point, it seems all combined together. But that is a desire to address that need. But it's also slow. It's, you know, mm-hmm. people get frustrated, and government is not set up to be the most nimble of animals. And that's certainly, I think, a frustration that everyone shares. But it is just the nature of the beast at this point. And we can, you know, I always have an open door. I've got a 100 cup of coffee project where I'm having 100 cups of coffee with 100 different constituents. They can reach out through any of my social media, Facebook, Twitter, email my council, and happy to talk about any topic. So if there's an idea that you can solve, shoot me an email.
Very interesting. I've been following that as well. I do have one more question, actually. It's a TIF question again. I need to ask it. So there's another project on 4th Street that's starting to take shape. I'm not going to mention the organization or anything, but they're going to be doing some work to revitalize that area of 4th Street because I don't want to put their stuff out there. Would something like that, I think you know what I'm talking about, would something like that be considered for a TIF district, or is that too small?
It could. I mean, it could. It definitely could qualify, depending on the analysis and site work that needs to take place. I know that we're going to look at, as a council with administration, how do we utilize different funding sources that have predominantly been used in the private development for public good, and how to direct those resources. So I guess stay tuned on that. But I think that there is a project. There's actually several projects that could likely be eligible for that if. In the absence of other funding from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency mm-hmm. or other, you know, low-income tax credit syndicates across the country, or, you know, the opportunity zone, that is just a new thing that we don't know the capabilities of it yet.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show today. Noah Hobbs is the president of the Duluth City Council. Thank you for coming in and sharing your wisdom and answering questions about TIF districts and CDBG and other sordid things related to the city of Duluth. This is People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Henry Banks. Thanks for listening. Have a great evening and a great weekend. Coming up next week on People of Color, it's the Martin Luther King Celebration Committee members. They're here to talk about the events and how you can get involved. All that next week on People of Color.